I grew up in a house that he built in the 30s in Switzerland. So, of course, I was like very close to that Bauhaus legacy. My name is Peter Fischli, and I'm the son of Hans Fischli.
I'm Gina Fischli. I'm an artist, and I'm a granddaughter of Hans Fischli.
I'm Freddy Fischli. I'm the grandson of Hans Fischli, and I'm a curator, and I'm working on an exhibition for Zentrum Paul Klee on Hans Fischli.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to a brand new episode of Bauhaus Faces. Thanks for tuning in again. This time we're going to talk about the Swiss architect and artist Hans Fischli. I was really happy and lucky to have been able to interview not only one, but three Fischlis at the same time. His son Peter and his grandchildren Freddy and Gina. In our conversation, we mostly concentrated on trying to get close to Hans Fischli as a person and to some of his works. So this time, I'll be the one telling you the biographical details. Because my interview partners sometimes used specific German words that are not so easy to translate, I decided to compile a glossary for you in the show notes. Whenever you are hearing a German word, please have a look there to find the English translation. If you are a first-time listener of Bauhaus Faces, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you're listening now. And I would be more than happy if you left a 5-star rating to help make the podcast more visible for others who don't know about Bauhaus Faces yet. So, without much further ado, let's now dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Hans Fischli. Hans Fischli was born on October 9, 1909 in Zurich. After failing the admission examination for the teacher training seminar, Fischli tried to find an apprenticeship as bricklayer or carpenter. However, due to some health issues, Fischli suffered from severe asthma attacks, no one accepted him. Finally, he found a position as draftsman in the architecture office Rugli in Zurich in 1925. In the Bauzeitung, an architectural magazine, Hans Fischli read about the Weißenhof estate in Stuttgart, headed by the well-known architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. Just a quick recommendation here to also listen to my podcast about Mies, in which you will find out what the Weißenhof estate meant for him. Spoiler alert, it was a real turning point. Fischli spontaneously decided to go and see the estate for himself and bought a ticket to Stuttgart, and he was impressed by the architecture that he saw there. On his way back home, Fischli read several brochures of the Weißenhof estate and learned that one of the houses was by Walter Gropius, founder and first director of the Bauhaus. Around the same time, Fischli visited an exhibition of abstract art at the Kunsthaus in Zurich. In his autobiography, Rapport, which he published in 1978, Fischli described that, "Since then, there was a restlessness in me." He now wanted to study architecture and painting with Paul Klee and Vasily Kandinsky, both teachers at the Bauhaus in Dessau. So he applied, sending construction plans, drawings, paintings, and photographs. One of it was a square moon that is still in the family, as Gina and Peter told me.
I have this drawing with the square moon, and you sometimes tell this story that this was something he did in the full course, no?
When he wanted to go to the Bauhaus, he had to send some works. So one of the work that he was sending them was a drawing of a square moon. And of course, he was accepted. And I mean, yeah, he was 19. He understood what they wanted.
His parents finally agreed to pay for 1 year the 120 marks he needed as a monthly support. He avoided the final exam of his apprenticeship as a draftsman. On the day of his exam, Fischli was sitting on a train to Dessau. Hans Fischli arrived on April 11, 1928 at the Bauhaus in Dessau. Like everyone else, he started his studies at the Bauhaus with the so-called Vorkurs, the preliminary course, with Joseph Albers. What stuck to his brain for the rest of his life was Albus's motto, make the most of what little you have, which he applied to the buildings he later designed. The month that Fischli came to the Bauhaus was also the beginning of a new era of the school. Walter Gropius had just left the Bauhaus and Hans Meyer had taken over, ready to change the structure of the workshops and the overall alignment. If you're interested in that topic, please find my episode of Bauhaus Faces about Hannes Meyer with Dara Kiese. Unfortunately, there are no works preserved from that time. After the Vorkurs, Fischli was admitted to the wall painting workshop headed by Hinek Schepa. As member of the wall painting workshop, he painted the newly built houses of the Dessau-Turten estate. He later wrote that, in addition to learning our craft, we also got to know the new houses well. For me, this was the people's version of Stuttgart's Weißenhof estate, which had prompted me to come here. During his second semester, Fischli participated in a wallpaper competition, which the wallpaper company Gebrüder Rasch had launched for the Bauhaus students. Most designs that the company bought were by Fischli. He received 239 Reichsmark and 16 Pfennig. But his designs were lost, so we don't know today what they actually looked like. The two-semester attendance in which the students were supposed to learn a craft was required to be finally admitted to the building department, but this never happened for Fischli. Although he had come to the Bauhaus to be trained as an architect, Fischli left at the end of March 1929 after only 1 year. Why is somewhat unclear. Maybe his parents couldn't afford the monthly support of 120 Reichsmarks anymore. After all, they had agreed on only 1 year. Until 1930, though, he was still registered at the Bauhaus on leave. For a while, he was sure he would come back, but it turned out differently for him. Even though Fischli had never studied architecture at the Bauhaus, he indeed made first attempts in becoming an architect. For a competition, he designed a kindergarten and neighborhood center in Zurich as a collaborative project with his Swiss fellow student Max Bill in 1928. Although they had high hopes of winning the competition, their plans flopped, and they were eliminated in the first round. Unbalanced structures was the merciless verdict of the jury's report.
When he came back, he refused to go to military service, and within the prison cell where they locked him up in the village of Meilen, he did drawings of biological cells, where you can really see the learnings from the Bauhaus, but in freer forms, not in a dogmatic, modernist way. But he would position himself as this pacifist that would be working in. Although then when he got out of the cell, he realized the danger and the resistance, and then he entered voluntarily to the military service.
This Zellengebilde, these drawings, are like super beautiful. Sometimes I regret that he was not longer in prison. No, he had to be like 90 days, and they are nine. Every day he made one of these.
Back from prison, Hans Fischli shortly returned to his old teacher, Robert Rugli, but quickly applied as a draftsman in the architecture office of Karl Hubacher and Rudolf Steiger, two architects that were bringing the new building to Switzerland. Fischli was surprised that he got the job. He was 20 years old at that point and started working on the Swiss Werkbund's Neubühl estate. First, he was responsible for drawing the submission plans. In 1930, he was assigned to the office responsible for constructing the estate. This is Freddy describing the Neubühl estate in Zurich for you.
It's situated on top of a hill, so a little bit in comparison to the house that he built, Hans Fischli, for himself and his parents. They had to move out of the city to find it, and through this, it is very much embedded with the landscape. You get like all these greeneries in between, and you sit on top of this hill and you can look down to the lake. It's like super idyllic, but at the time it was like regarded as something suburbs, like out of it. And then it's really built as one master plan, the way that you circulate, also that when you come in, there is children's daycare, there is the fountain that Hans Fischli built also as a communal place where you can go. There is this studio for guests. I think that they also were, that is still functioning today. And I think this was also built from the start. And it's like built existential minimum. It's like super cheap and small, but it has a lot of terraces and gathering places for communal living. It was so central that it was this Siedlung, because otherwise there were singular modernist buildings like the factories or the house that he would be building, but the whole programmatic idea of also building for existential minimum, but in a beautiful way, with a garden within nature sitting on top of the hill. It was like the presentation of how we should build for the future.
Hans Fischli once wrote about his time with Hubacher and Steiger, "In the office, it's not just drawing plans that makes money. If you remember Albers, you become an employee who has a say." Hans Fischli was thriving on challenges and rose from draftsman to architect of the new building style. Now it was time to establish his own architectural office.
He worked also a little bit in other offices, but then he was a very charismatic figure. He wouldn't be the one that could be working for others. It was more about him that also set up his own system of working. And within that, there was Michel Parasol, your godfather and adopted brother that lost his family in Paris and was adopted by the family and lived with them, but also worked heavily kind of his whole life with Hans Fischli running the office.
Yeah, but unfortunately, Michel Parasol is no more here. He could like tell all this story because he was right from the beginning on always in the office. But I don't know the details. I was not born back then when he was coming back from the Bauhaus. I just then know these stories also by him telling about them.
His masterpiece and first house as an independent architect was the so-called Schlestut in Obermeilen that he built for his own family. It is a rational, unsentimental house made of wood with a protruding flat roof. It was built through and through in the spirit of classical modernism. Big windows flooded the rooms with natural light. Only the most necessary space was calculated, cheap materials used, and the building was adapted to the hilly building side. From the east, it seems to be a single-story bungalow. From the south, a long, beautiful house with more windows than walls. From the west, it looks like a narrow, three-story building. The family moved into the ship-like house after only 100 days of construction time.
He went quite young to the Bauhaus, and then he came back and he wanted to build a house, and he convinced his father, my grandfather, to sell their house in Zurich. They had a small house, so he convinced them to sell that house, and with that money they could build the Schlestut. Because, of course, when you are 24, you don't have a client who is doing that. So it's kind of astonishing that my grandfather said yes to that. Also a certain risk, because he had no experience. It was his first house. But he was at the Bauhaus. But back then, it's like the Bauhaus then didn't have a legacy. You know, it was not, it's just like, yeah, some insiders would know, oh, this is a really good school. But it was not like a household thing, that knowing that Bauhaus is something. So my grandfather, in a way, trusted him. But the budget was not big, you know, because that house, it was like an Reihenhaus back then, a little bit in the suburbs of Zurich, in Wollishofen. So they had like to look for cheap land and a cheap way of doing it. And the cheap land they found, now it's an irony, they found it at the Goldküste, which is now the most expensive land or place. And also back then in the 30s, there was also not a Bauzonen. You could build a house wherever you wanted. And the more you went up the hill, the cheaper it came. So then he built that house up there. And the deal with, was also with my grandfather that this would be the house for the whole family, including them. So I grew also up with my grandfather and grandmother. Grandmother was blind, so she needed a little bit of help. I mean, construction-wise, it was, as I said, it was like very simple. It was a steel skeleton and the rest all with wood. So just like wood boards, but they were like placed horizontal. So not like, as you would know it, like from these American houses, with they would be vertical, they were horizontal. So a very, very simple way of doing it. There was no basement, because then you had to make a Baugrube and all these things. So they just, yeah, that's expensive. So everything that would be on the ground floor, it was, I would say, 2/3 was open, and this was like his studio for making sculptures, deine Werkstatt. And then the second floor on the right side, it was the rooms for my grandparents. And on the left side, it was the family, yeah, where we lived. And then on the top floor with a nice terrace and a beautiful studio, it was his studio. So he also organized it a little bit clever. So he had like, yeah, he had the Filetstück. Yeah. And something that was also like super special, the staircase was outside. The house had no staircase inside, also for making it like more simple. So in winter, when we had to go to another floor, we always had to go out, which then my mother, at a certain moment, I think she protested, and they made like a provisory staircase. So one could go up to his floor, you know, not going outside. Then my parents, they divorced in the mid-60s. But I think the first thing he did was taking that stair out. Yeah, also, it's like, it's always the problem when you build a house that the rooms, that you eat up too many space for Verkehrswege, you know? So then this was like something separate, and it made it just like very clear. And the house was quite radical in his simplicity. So one thing was also, like, big windows didn't exist then, or they existed or would be like super expensive. So he used single glass, which is like for heating, not the best, and industrial glass, because the industrial glass is also cheaper. But the industrial glass, it doesn't have an even thickness. So when you were standing and looking, and the view is the best possible view you can imagine, because like you had all the Swiss mountains. But when we were standing in the living room and moving our head up and down, the landscape would make psychedelic distortions. Whoa. So this is just like an example. Also, the technique for the flat roof was not mature. But he wanted to do it. It was done like very simple. So it was leaking. But this was like then on the top floor. This was something we were not allowed to talk about, you know? It was the elephant in the room. And just like once a year, they did a paint job. It was just like overpainting it. And it was not leaking that like water would fall in my soup. Not like that. It's still existent. Unfortunately, it's no more in the family. My father sold it, or he made a contract for selling it a year before he died.
It's quite outstanding how simple the house has been done. I think the original budget was only 20,000 Swiss francs.
80,000
Swiss francs. Yeah, like yeah. A really low number for a big...
Yeah, yeah. With the land and everything.
Yeah.
Also, there was something like nearly like Spartanic about it. I mean, like all this Bauhaus kind of glamorous or luxury thing that was like total absent. Back then, everything, like the room that I lived in it and had to share with my brother, it had space for two beds and just like a corridor to get to your bed. But the kitchen was like incredibly small. Everything was like this idea of the minimum, no, was like very important. Also, the doors for the kitchen and the bedroom were only 45 centimeters, like very small, because it's just like eating up space. And I remember he told me that he measured back then when you went on a train, the train doors were also like very small. And he measured just the door of the trains, which was like 45 centimeters, and said, well, everybody can get in and out. Why should I make bigger doors? I mean, when he got older, he had quite a nice belly. And so he had like to squeeze him.
You know, but like, all these decisions were very programmatic.
With the experience of building his own house, the Schlestut, Fischli planned the workers' settlement Gwart in Weddenswil in 1943. The terrace settlement was established on the initiative of Walter Blattmann, an industrialist from Weddenswil. A cooperative was founded, local authorities had made land available under building law. This way, local workers were given the opportunity to build their own home with little or no capital of their own. They contributed their labor, and the architect planned the houses cost-effectively. Fischli calculated how big a house could be for a family in which the father, with wife and four children, earned 6,000 francs in 1942. His result was that they could afford a house of 82 square meters. Each house couldn't cost more than 18,000 francs, he calculated. And he also calculated the permissible shaded area for the development of the property based on the angle of the sunlight. The rows of houses were staggered on top of each other in the north-south orientation so that the apartments received morning and evening sun. The result was an entire village in which every house had a view of the lake of the neighboring roofs. Adapted to the slope of the terrain, the settlement was barely visible. 28 families moved in and lived in healthy conditions in a modern, cost-saving settlement. Fischli knew about his social responsibility. It was something that he had learned at the Bauhaus. In an interview on Swiss television in 1981, Fischli said that he had learned at the Bauhaus to think new from the very start, and that new architecture didn't just mean to build a house with a flat roof, but that the new form, according to Fischli, develops from the lighting of the rooms. His strong social commitment and his understanding of new modern architecture is also evident in his involvement in the planning and realization of the Pestalozzi children's village in Trogen between 1944 and 49, this time in a more traditionally Swiss style. Mr. Blattmann, the initiator of the workers' settlement, then commissioned Hans Fischli to plan a new metalware factory in Weddenswil. Fischli himself enjoyed designing factory buildings even more than private houses because, quote, industrial clients give you their full support since you build objectively, that means based on function, and since you think about the economic aspects. Fischli stressed in an interview that the Bauhaus not only educated and formed architects, but also the first industrial designers. At the Bauhaus, he said, "We assumed that designs should be made for industry, suitable for machines or materials." This approach and buildings like the Bauhaus in Dessau itself or the ADGB Trade Union School in Bernau all very deliberately used ideas from factory buildings to construct efficiently and to keep costs low. Big windows with opening mechanisms to open several windows at once, shed roofs or skylights to direct natural light into the building, long glass passageways or bridges to connect different parts of a building, and so on. Fischli seems to have done a satisfactory job on the metalware factory, as the Blattmanns recommended him to the company Adolf Feller AG, for whom Fischli would plan numerous buildings during the next 3 decades. He always started with what he had internalized at the Bauhaus, to look at the basic factors, So for factories, Fishley studied the workflow of the production before even thinking about the building to understand what is being needed, where what is needed, and how it is supposed to look. This way, he was able to involve the owners and operation managers and make sure to uncover errors and voids early on in the process. Fishley then looked at the nature of the construction site, hilly or even landscape, and at what materials to use to keep costs within limits. His factory buildings for the Bloodmans and the Fellers are not only functional and satisfied Fishley's clients, but they also looked beautiful and extraordinary. For an extension building for the Feller AG, a manufacturer of electrical engineering products, he translated the shed roof onto the facade, this way creating a unique look of zigzag glazing and at the same time supplying the rooms behind it with indirect natural light. This helped promote the face of the company too. It also embodies a clear vision of modern architecture and design, an interplay of functionality and aesthetics.
The first was the house in Milan. And through this, in a way, he managed to have these clients that was the factory Feller and the factory Metallbau Blattmann. These were then the big clients in the beginning, but also before it was the Pestalozzi-Dorf. And the Pestalozzi-Dorf, which was an asylum for children that came from France or Germany, Jewish, you know, this was like the beginning.
In the beginning, just speaking of the anti-fascist movement, I think we should also mention your mother, Elena Fischli-Dreher, who was really coming from the partisan movement out of Italy and was strongly involved with children education, therefore also the building of Drogen, Pestalozzi, of, not just as an architect, but really as a dealing with the world was so much embedded.
I think Switzerland was also a little bit like divided then. And that's what's showing the history of Switzerland is that certain people had sympathy for Nazi Germany. But then there was this strong will to sneak through with neutrality and stay out of the war. And one of the symbols was like the Landesausstellung. That was very important, that Hans Fischli also was working with. He was the Chefadjutant from the general architect.
For the Landesausstellung, the Swiss National Exhibition, also affectionately called Landi, Hans Fischli worked as exhibition architect from 1936 to 39. He was responsible for the well-received amusement palace and the children's paradise, which he was very proud of. Let's return to Peter and Freddy Fischli, who will now address Switzerland's role during the wartime and what effect it had on Swiss art and architecture.
You know, Switzerland really then tried to have this own identity. And it was also the moment when my father, who was a pacifist, but then he went to the army, you know, said, okay, but now I have to rethink my position. And he went to the army without, never did like the whole, this like learning process, the Rekrutenschule. But he was just like then in the Planungsstab. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, the modernists had to convince against the so-called Heimatstil. The Heimatstil, when you arrive in Zurich, you find like a fake castle that was also built as a kind of nationalistic idea. The Landesmuseum, it is now. And slowly through this like little circle also around Siegfried and Carola Gideon of internationally connected modernists, they could, through Landesausstellung and things that would be representative, get into the kind of main culture of Switzerland. But it was like a small group of people around universities and art schools.
What Freddy mentioned, it's interesting because there was like this geistiger Widerstand, but this geistiger Widerstand, it was not like completely open for modernists because they had like this kind of Heimatstil, and they are some of really interesting architects like Hans Leutzlinger, and they were like influenced a little bit by the regional way of how to build houses, and they wanted to use the same materials, and it was called Unaufgeregte Moderne, not like really looking for a provocative different style, but just like how to embed it in a certain way in something what Freddy described, Heimatstil. They were really looking at these kind of houses and not going for a complete interruption.
We have now discussed Hans Fischli's architecture quite extensively. Let's have a short look at his development as a painter for a moment. After his first steps during his 90-day imprisonment, when he produced his Zellengewilde, the cell structures, his drawings and paintings gradually developed into images of more abstract biomorphic forms. In 1932, Fischli became, like Max Bill, member of the Parisian artist group Abstraction Création. In this group, he was now eye to eye with his former Bauhaus teacher Vasily Kandinsky, who had also been one of the reasons why he had originally wanted to go study at the Bauhaus. Fischli's paintings eventually became bigger. Following a personal and professional crisis after the 1947 Zücker exhibition, the exhibition architect was blamed for the poor economic success, Fischli underwent an intense experimental phase. He mixed sand and ash into his pigments and hurled, crushed, burned and crusted this mixture on wooden panels, creating aggressively expressive, materially driven works. It is the same time when Fischli also began with sculpture. In the 1950s, Fischli's paintings calmed down. He now primarily turned to overlapping geometric structures in his compositions. Through repeated masking, painting, sanding and polishing, he produced multi-layered, translucent works. During the last years, the circle, the square and occasionally the spiral became his preferred motifs in his paintings and also in his sculptures. They breathe silent meditation and harmony. I asked his son Peter if his father was a well-known artist. This was his answer.
In Switzerland, he was quite successful, and there was like this gallery in Zurich, Susanne Bolag, which showed the Zürcher Konkrete. And he was also in that group, Allianz. So back then, it was also kind of hard to be an international artist, also because of the war, and there was like not that many exchanges. But he did a retrospective at the Kunsthaus in 68, and he was always working. But his art, and especially in the beginning more like paintings and drawings, and then more and more in the 60s, he was doing a lot of sculpture. This is also something that I remember from my youth. On the weekend or like in the evening, he had extremely energy because after like teaching and or like being director of the school, he had to go to the architectural office, which he had a partner, Eichholzer and Michel Parasol. And I mean, they were like also taking care of a lot of the things. But then in the evening and at night, he would doing his paintings or working on his sculptures, doing a lot of stone sculptures, which he sizzled by himself. And I remember just always like hearing like this sizzle, duck, 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 duck. And that was like on the weekend. He was just like doing that. Yeah, like with the paintings, it was like often when he finished the painting, then the whole family had to look at the painting. But you just had to look at the painting, not talking too much. And I just remember in the beginning, there were some figurative things. But then it was like abstract or concrete, konkrete Kunst. And this was also something he was like really talking bad about, like figurative, oh, that's a figurative artist, you know.
When Hans Fischli became director of the School of Applied Arts at the Museum of Applied Arts in Zurich in 1954, his focus shifted to communicate what he had learned from his educators at the Bauhaus. He adapted the Bauhaus idea and was inspired by Max Bild's program for the Ulm School of Design, the HFG Ulm. So he put the forecourse, the preliminary course, at the center of the studies at the School of Applied Arts. After an election, the head of the school authority changed. From then on, there were constant quarrels at the school about the reform program and about Fischli's own architectural office that he continued to operate. When Fischli felt that he could no longer trust the head and his colleagues, he left the school and museum in 1961. If you are interested in the principles and the curriculum of the Ulm School of Design, the HFG Ulm, you should definitely not miss to listen to my bonus episode on Bauhaus Faces with Martin Menteler, head of the HFG Ulm archive. And if you are interested in listening to more about Max Bill, there's also a whole episode waiting for you. During our interview, Freddy told me that Hans Fischli had always been interested in educating people, not only as director of the School of Applied Arts in Zurich, but from the very beginning onward, even on the construction sites of the buildings that he designed, planned and built.
He was a big educator, and working with Hans Fischli and also all the stories that I hear from him, by also my mother was always so deeply impressed by him. He could really explain you the world out of his learnings from the Bauhaus. And I guess this building, it wasn't just only for living, for him or his family, but kind of to showing in a radical way the principles that he learned at the Bauhaus. And then also became this figure in the city, of course, next to Max Bill, but then also Hans Fischli became the director of the Kunstgewerbe Museum in Zurich, where the whole
And Schule. Yeah. To this also, he came very close to the younger generation. But just going back to this kind of teachings, I remember when I was a young teenager, we often went on the weekend to see a building somewhere that he was interested. And then he said, who wants to come with? And for me, it was just like the possibility. Then we took the train to Geneva or Bern or Basel and looked at some buildings he was interested. And once I was saying something about like a building, but this is also built in the style of the Bauhaus. And then he said, Bauhaus is not a style, es ist eine Gesinnung.
Working as an architect and artist at the same time, that this wasn't considered like as different disciplines, but one understanding of how we want to build the world. And the Kunstgewerbeschule, definitely, that even people that would be working in fashion, like I had a neighbor, would refer to Hans Fischli. Like it would be really diverse, the learnings that would be happening there. And this was also the programmatic idea.
I think the Kunstgewerbe Museum and Kunstgewerbe Schule already had the strong Bauhaus legacy in it. It was built by Karl Egender, which was also, I think Egender was not at the Bauhaus, but like very influenced of the Bauhaus. And it was Itten that was before him, also director. So the Bauhaus idea was already there. And that's maybe also because he was elected as a director for it.
And also because of the war. That's also something that we often talk about, that they had to protect the ideas of the Bauhaus here in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. It was closed mm-hmm. in Germany. So mm-hmm. even more it made them obliged to not overcome, but in a way continue the tradition of the learnings.
Yeah, I mean that modernism was also really also the counter voice against Nazi Germany. And so it has a much larger meaning than sometimes it's that you just see it as a movement that is like inside of art and culture. It was like really something political.
And then modernism was so much preserved because it had to be, that maybe Switzerland, the culture was also a little bit late to rethink. And maybe for a next generation, it became a little bit too dogmatic, that only the Zürcher Konkreten, Zürcher that this is the only way that art could be made, where if you would compare it to the original Bauhaus ideas, which were much more mixed and discussed in which direction it goes, it ended up in a maybe in a too rigid understanding of modernism.
Yeah, but when you look at it a little bit more closely, you can see that it was not like one day it was this and then the next day. It was like it went step by step. And in especially in Zurich, it's interesting the example of the Hausmanns, the architect Hausmanns, and they were like really good friends with my father. And they were modernists. Then starting going like in a very Swiss way into postmodernism. And my father was open to that. So in a way, it was the transmission. It was happening as a dissolve, something like that, and not an ideological war. And
but you must tell the story when Hans Fischli worked together. It's Robert Hausmann.
Yeah, that's like, it's
this
one
is
of.
Very telling.
So, for the Gartenbauausstellung in the 60s, there was ein Wettbewerb for doing a kiosk in all the parks around the lake. And Hans Fischli and Robert Hausmann, they made a project together. And the project was, let's just do a 3 meter ball. And then it could go open, and also you can place them everywhere, like these balls, and they would be like kiosk where people can buy sandwiches or ice cream. And then when they had to make the plan, Robert Hausmann said, listen, Hans, if you want that this looks, because it's 3 meter, we have to make it slightly distorted. Because when you look from down and you do a ball, it will look like a flat egg. So we have to make it a little bit distorted. And then my father said, no way. There is only one truth, and this is the geometrical truth. And in a way, they went apart because of that.
And Hans Fischli was like clear on the point, a ball is a ball.
It's for me the best example to explain the difference between a modernist and a postmodernist. You know, that you say, no, the postmodernist would say, no, the image is important. I think I have to add something. They reflected and they would also laugh about it. It's not that he was not like this kind of dogmatic, you know. They would like joking about it. It's important to say that.
In the end, I asked my favorite question, and that's, what is your favorite piece of art by Hans Fischli? And this is what Peter, Freddy and Gina answered.
It goes a little bit through all the periods. Of course, the Zellengebilde, I like a lot of the things, like from 30s, 40s, but then also like from the 60s, some of the sculptures. It's not a certain period that I like most. Yeah, just like individual works that I think they are like formally very strong or.
I would say it is somewhat the early work, because maybe it's also further away, and the later work maybe resembles Zurich modernism that I also know from other artists, but like how the early work, Klee and Albers, the teachers really push through and give also this kind of dreamy, mysterious, figurative paintings that still I don't get it as much as like the later abstract work, and how this playfulness goes together with the wooden architecture that is also done in a kind of humble way. That I like a lot, because then the later work, I also know the TV interviews that he did that is still there, and you can see him as this like giant man. He was like really big and like so dogmatic, kind of in a way, the man that knows everything, that there is also a different, more mysterious early side. This I'm intrigued by.
Yeah, I connect a lot to the Zellen Gebilde, but there are so many works that have mysterious and also tender sides that are really interesting. But I haven't seen a lot of the work yet, and I'm really excited for the exhibition you're about to do, also to discover more and really look at things that were maybe in the archive for a while that I've never seen.
As you might have noticed, we haven't covered Hans Fischli's paintings and sculptures as much as his architecture. But his architecture is what he is most known for today. Fischli was one of the few architects who brought new building to Switzerland. He added his very own and personal note by using wood as building material to keep construction costs low and to coin a very specific appearance. There are many more buildings that Hans Fischli designed that we haven't mentioned in this podcast episode. Single-story holiday houses, a studio house for the Bauhaus master Oskar Schlemmer, and multi-story apartment buildings. If you want to know more about Hans Fischli, you can find all relevant links, as always, in the show notes. Or you just go and visit the exhibition at Zentrum Polklee that Freddy is currently arranging. From the end of January 2026, he will exhibit paintings and drawings by Hans Fischli within the Cosmos Klee of Zentrum Polklee. If you liked this episode or any other episode of Bauhaus Faces, please don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or YouTube and recommend it to your friends, family or colleagues. And don't forget to subscribe to my podcast newsletter on bauhausfaces.com to stay up to date about new episodes of Bauhaus Faces. And now, there's nothing left to say but tune in next time for a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.